God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Holy moly, here we go again, huh? I think Aristotle said that the unexamined life is not worth living. The unexamined life is not worth living. Because otherwise, I don't think we're living, we're drifting. Could anybody agree with that notion? You know, and we're not setting our sights on anything because maybe what's going on right now is okay. Or it's tolerable, you know, whatever. But the only thing in my life and in my perception that matters is who are we in God. So have you ever seen the movie The Matrix? Anybody? I assign that as spiritual viewing to the people I sponsor. No kidding. Because we've got people who are going along hypnotized. I'm not being critical. I'm just saying that so many of us, you know, activity is reckoned as productivity, and it's not necessarily true. So in The Matrix, I wrote down all these quotes from The Matrix. I wish I'd brought them. She knows them all. Marcella, stand up. No. All right. So I'm going to paraphrase this one. I'll say it and then I'll tell you the way I live it. In it, one of the characters says, the Matrix cannot tell you who you are. And I say, the world cannot tell you who you are. You know, we sort of, there's a guy named Kleban, he did cartoons. I don't know if anybody's ever seen him. But he had a cartoon with all these guys in black suits in line. And the title of the cartoon was Business on Parade, and they all had each other's noses up the other guy's rear end. And that we need to have corporations. We need to have communities that try to do things. But I'm not here to be led by somebody. I'm here to be led by the God who made me. And, you know, frankly, in my selfishness, I say it ought to look better. But it looks exactly the way it's supposed to look. And because of all the suffering that we've had, and believe me, there are people, obviously, who've had much more suffering than we have had. But you know, the suffering you have is enough, yeah? We have learned, you know, I've learned that people can sit down with me in AA and say, you don't understand. And I'm pretty sure I can say that I do understand. Because I've worn that shirt, I've put those shoes on, and it makes us useful. And it says in the big book, we don't talk down to anyone from a spiritual hilltop. So there's an example. There was this priest in the 1800s, late 1800s, by the name of Father Damien. And Father Damien was a Belgian priest, and his bishop came to him and said, Father, we have a new assignment for you. We're going to send you to Hawaii because they need a priest in Hawaii, so we're going to send you. And he said, okay. And he said, we're going to send you to the Isle of Molokai. And Molokai was, and I don't know if it still is, a leper colony. And so Father Damien went and he put on his sneakers and did the best job he could to take care of his flock and be of service as a minister to them. And, you know, they liked Father Damien. They liked Father Damien right up until the day he stood up at the pulpit at Mass and he said, we lepers. And then they loved him. You see what I'm saying? We lepers. We walk this road. Nobody knows how hard it is sometimes for us to get out of bed. Nobody knows how hard it is for us to be transparent and actually share with somebody and let them in because we're so afraid we're going to be hurt. And it goes on and on and on. But we lepers, we know. and we can meet each other right square, eyeball to eyeball. So, we're coming up on step four. We made a, you know, when I do this, I can't remember the off the wall. What is it off the wall? We made a inventory. Fearless, what is it?
Fearless
and moral inventory. I've only been in it at 45 years. Don't, you know. I can never do it. I look at the book and I'm going, Mr. Brown, where is it? So, that's it. Keep coming back. Amen. I can count on Laura. She's got me. Searching and fearless moral inventory. Thank you for your help. This is, it takes a village to get. So, I looked at it initially and I thought it was inadequate, of course. How can, you know, resentments, fear, and sex inventory cover the bases? But I really didn't have another plan, and plus I'm lazy. I didn't want to add anything to it. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease, for we've been not only mentally and physically ill, we've been spiritually sick. You know, I tell people it's not that much fun to be mentally ill. We want to dismiss this line. I'm not mentally ill. What are you talking about, mentally ill? I'm mentally ill. And I think it's showing. We've been not only mentally and physically ill, we've been spiritually sick. Okay. When the spiritual maladies overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. We don't go to the gym to recover. It's okay to be fit. But I've never seen anybody outrun alcoholism. What's wrong with us is not ethyl alcohol. That's not what's wrong with us. 9 out of 10 people can drink alcohol with more or less impunity. There's a heavy drinker, yeah, fair enough. But only one in 10 have this reaction to alcohol and this baggage. If I find out that you have alcohol, that relationship with alcohol, it's like the red flag that flies, and I know so much about you because I know that with it comes all the rest of this. So how do we get over it? Do we just like hang on? Do we white knuckle it? Do we just like do affirmations in the mirror? My cousin used to stand in front of the mirror and say, you good looking son of a bitch, don't you ever die. I've adopted that one. Sorry. Anyway. So, I grew up in a culture in Alcoholics Anonymous that the bottle was the issue, the bottle's the issue, that's what the deal is, and if you don't drink and we've overcome it, we've climbed Mount Everest and we're home. And then I looked and I noticed that every one of our state poobahs, I don't know, you know, in the state structure, chairman, we're all divorced. And I may be brand new. I'm an alcoholic. I'm not stupid. You know what I'm saying? I'm not trying to criticize them. God knows the conditions of their lives and what happened and all. But I'm looking at this and I'm saying, you know, there may be more wrong with us than the way we drank. And I know for me, I had that loaded 32 automatic and I meant it. So it turns out that if we will deal with the spiritual malady, we'll straighten out mentally and physically. You know, and we'll be able to do things we never did before, like fix the water heater, or even a tap that's dripping. I mean, that's big doings, man, I tell you. God gave me these things, and it was useless. I could not drive a nail with a hammer. And now I work in precision all day long, 6 days a week. And there's no erase in leather. So here we go. It really builds your prayer up, but anyway. Where does it hurt? That's the question. If somebody were to ask you, where does it hurt? You know, I'm pretty sure that if we gave it a couple of moments' thought, we wouldn't say it hurts here in our coconut. It hurts in my soul. And I didn't really know I had one. I'd gotten training that said I had one. But it hurts in my soul. And what I did is I sold my soul for a pat on the back. Anybody else have that experience? Right? Please be my, you know, I had this motto, he may be a jerk, but he's the only friend I have. That's the way I lived my life. It hurts in my heart. I'm getting a little feedback, Jim, on this thing. Are you getting it at all?
Yeah.
Thank you. So, okay, here comes this moment. I took a vacation from sponsorship in my program, in my life, in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I would confer with my brother wizards, you know, we would talk about what's up and I'm drifting, right? And then one day I meet her, another her. And I had this four-month affair of the heart. I did not have a sexual affair. I had this affair of the heart. And I'm 23 years sober. And, you know, at one, I didn't know that there are things that exist in the world. I just didn't know it. I didn't know that there's something more powerful than heroin, something more powerful than fentanyl. It is somebody worshiping me. They're going to lift me up. They're going to give me a reason to be around. And hey, we are watching our business go down, and it's tanking like nobody's business. Marie is holding off the creditors, and I'm hanging around her. She's a nice enough person. That's not the issue. The issue is I didn't know that I was right walking into a wall. I was walking right into a bullet, and I didn't know it. Before God, I did not know it. And so at one point, this was a four-month affair, and I stood out under the sun one day, and I said to God, I choose her over you. And she decided to end this affair, and I staggered around for a while, and then I had an office that I didn't pay rent on. I had a phone that didn't ring. I had an AstroTurf carpet on this thing. And Marie was not there that day, and I slid out of my chair, and I was in a blackness that I'd never experienced in my life. It was so dark, I would never wish anybody to go there. If you define hell as the absence of God, I went there for 4 hours. And I laid down on the floor with a knife at my wrist. And I said, this is it. I mean, because a suicide is a person who eliminates options. You know, the world gets smaller. I can't do this, and it's really going to be bad, so I'm not going to do that. And pretty soon it's down to there's only one option. And that option was to take my life. So I'm there, and I got the knife at my wrist, and I say, oh, I'm going to do it in 5 minutes. And I did that every 5 minutes for 4 hours. And I went to hell. And by the grace of this God who would not listen to me, thank you, on this thing about who you're going to choose over me, I fell asleep. Right? And so I fell asleep. And I woke up in the morning. Marie did not know where I was, what was going on. And I had remembered I'd met this woman in Minneapolis. And she knew of a guy in St. Paul who was like a deep breather in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I figured I needed a deep breather. So I got in touch with her, and I told her what was going on. And she immediately got, I was 23 years sober, she was 16 years sober. She got her AA books in her lap, and she started 12-stepping me. And so the more I listened to her, the more I thought, you know, she has everything I want. She has everything I want. And I said, would you be my sponsor? And she said, oh, no, let's keep the boy-girl thing cooking, you know. Man, I'd have asked a fire hydrant to sponsor me if it had worked. And so the more she talked, the more I said, would you be my sponsor? And she says, I tell you what. Oh, and I told, going into this, which was not a final moment in my life, thank you, God, I used to say two things. I used to say, I can't breathe, and would you please give me a cookie? I just wanted something sweet. I didn't have anything sweet in my life. So I'm talking to this woman on the phone. She says, I tell you what, I will work with you until you can find a male sponsor. And I said, okay. And so she saved my life, and her name was Cookie. Straight up. Her name was Cookie, and Cookie worked with me for 4 years, and she brought me back up into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and then I got sponsors, and I went on that way. Why do I bring it up now? Where does it hurt? I never knew I really, truly had a soul until it was hurt so badly laying on that floor. You know, and you know what the drink of a longtime sober person is normally? It's a bullet. Because we don't want to lose our place in the pecking order. I told you there's all these layers in us. Now, Marie did not know I was having that affair, and I got hold of her after that, and I said, Marie, this is what's going on, and I told her everything that was happening. And I said, listen, this is the time. You're either going to stand with me, not as a demand, but I'm just telling you the reality of this. You're either going to stand with me or we're not going to make it. And she stood up with me and in that affair, because I told her, I said, God, I don't know what's happening. And she stood with me and she walked me out of that affair.
And the way that I did that was, I had some great direction initially in the program because I didn't know how to treat Mickey from the very beginning. I had no tools. She said, you treat Mickey like you would another Al-Anon. You treat him as well as you would treat a newcomer coming in with confusion and hurt, and that was regarding other stuff, but I pulled on that when he was going through this. And so I took off my white hat and put on my Al-Anon hat. And I went with him through, because so much of what he was going through were things that I had learned in Al-Anon. It was by the grace of God. I didn't do that because I'm such a great person. I did that because I valued him. I loved him. I was confused by the whole situation. How do I not take it personally? When a newcomer comes in and they are crazy as hell, you don't take it personally. It's, you know it's not about you. It's truly about the demons that are inside. And I somehow God gave me the blessing of not seeing his demons as relating to me. They related to him. They were from everything he had ever lived and been and learned, and you know, and I had a choice. But the training I got in these rooms, you know, if you have a situation where you want to take something personally, just put on your AA Al-Anon hat and listen as you would to a newcomer. So that's how we got through it. I am eternally grateful that we did, because again, everything that we have that is a challenge and horrible situations can translate into wonderful blessings. I trust him more than I ever could have before that happened. I remember one time we were talking about it, and it was a horrible, horrible time. And I don't know if I asked him or he asked me, would you change it? And I would not have changed that period of time, because what resulted from it was a closeness that we know we can get through anything. You know, we really do.
Thank you, sweetie. And so, blessings, right? Coming out of this thing, and I came up, and the only voices that I could listen to were Vietnam veterans. Both my brothers fought in Vietnam. I didn't. I had bad hinges. My knees wouldn't allow me to get in uniform. And so I was reading these books, and they were like Vietnam veterans rap groups and so on down the line. And in there was this discussion. They said, well, we have PTSD, and we know what that is. That's what we call it now. And then in Korea, we had shell shock, and we had, you know, various names going down. And in the Confederate War, they had what they called soldier's heart. And I changed the name to orphan heart. Now, if you have orphan heart, I guarantee you, sitting in this room right now, you just got nailed. That orphan heart is what drew me in to that relationship with that woman, because she offered me mothering. She offered me, I look up to you, you're all this stuff, and I needed it so desperately. Turns out it is lethal to play that game. And so, with God's grace, I'm writing a book so that others who are in that situation can find out that alcoholism isn't the only thing that can scuttle you. This orphan heart will draw somebody into your life, and everybody thinks it's going to be good, and it's really not so good. So this isn't a weekend on orphan heart, but I hope you don't mind my sharing other pitfalls that are waiting us out there in this world. So how's that for step four? What the hell? It gives us directions in here for what we're to inventory, and we do that. Is there any specific you wanted to say on that?
Just that I've had a really hard time initially with inventory. I love it now, but initially I had a really hard time because as a turtle personality, my shell was, I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine. I was committed to that. Ask Mickey. and it's like, I think it's why Al-Anon is so small. You know? We have this commitment. I'm fine. And that's really how I felt. I'm fine. And so it takes a while to chip away at that to where we can say, well, okay, there are some things I can look at. And thank God we have the big book method of inventory, because it doesn't say, you know, okay, how screwed up are you? Because I'm fine. It says, okay, where were you? Fearful, selfish, self-seeking, dishonest. And then it has the fear inventory and it has a sex inventory. It took me 25 years to do my sex inventory. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Oh, you got to hear this one. It's great. I mean, really great. No. So on the technical side of things, on the resentment inventory, on the resentment inventory, it's like, you know, we have the columns and so on. So we put the person and then the cause, and then we have affects my. So I ask, the way I do inventory is I put the categories in the third column and the categories in the fourth column, and I write a notation for what I meant. We got to know we mean something when we can put down the words that affects my self-esteem. All I'm doing is writing down what I mean by that. I feel less than. This person made me feel small in front of them, so on. Because the third column will establish all the themes of my life. That's where I ping pong in my life, is in that third column. Now I'm getting a picture of my soul. This is the condition of my soul. So I encourage you to flesh out the third column categories and the fourth column categories. Otherwise, an inventory could be like this. I'm resentful at Joe Blow. Why? He called me skinny. It affects my self-esteem. I'm just going to do, you know, it affects my self-esteem. And my fault. I'm dishonest and frightened. And now you don't know anything about what it was like for me to be called skinny by this man. Or I could write, I'm resentful at Joe Blow. He called me skinny. It affects my self-esteem. I esteem myself to be of Sylvester Stallone. In my fourth column, I'm dishonest. I am skinny. Do you see what I mean? That man didn't hurt me. I hurt me by carrying this false image of myself. It made me just available. I'm leading with my chin. Does this make sense? You see what I'm saying? So if I flesh them out, I will not only get a clearer picture and a more thorough picture of what's really going on in my life, but so will my sponsor. Because he can listen to this and say, oh, I see where you're coming from. And then he knows that the next time when he can cripple me with a question. And going into that fourth column, it says, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely look for our own mistakes. So there's a shift between the third column and the fourth column. I mean, it's a shift I can almost feel in my chest. Now, I've gotten that person, what they did that offended me, I've gotten how it affected me. So far, it's me. But what they did. Now we go into the fourth column. And if I don't experience a shift in the fourth column, I didn't do my inventory. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because it's my fault. It's my fault. What's hurting me is my fault. Okay. Okay, now we're going to fear inventory. Notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside Mr. Brown and so on down the line. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. So when I first was in Alcoholics Anonymous, I got this sponsor and I picked him because he looked like the prophet Isaiah. I mean, he had the hair and the beard, and I thought, man, I'm home with this guy.
He had the eyebrows, too.
Yeah, he had everything. So, but it turns out he didn't work the program out of the book. Right? So the fear inventory was for him was this: list everything that you're afraid of. I'm afraid of the dark, I'm afraid of the light, I'm afraid of crowds, I'm afraid to be alone, and that's all I'm writing. Dang-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding, I'm getting nothing. I'm getting nothing out of this. So let's see what the big book has to say about a fear inventory. So we know the four columns in the resentment inventory. So I write a four-sentence paragraph for every fear. But I make a master list first. I'm afraid of these things. And then I inventory it. When I did it at first, it was open-ended. I had no idea where I was going. Is there an end to this inventory? So it kept being added, and I was doing a searching and fearless and never-ending inventory. Because that guy cut me off on the street today, and blah, blah, blah. I went on like that. So I make a master list of my fears. Then I pick one off. Now, I also write a prayer across the page at the top of every page of inventory. It does not say to do that in the book, But I write a little prayer like, God, thank you for the truth and the freedom, or whatever it is that I write, or help, whatever it is. Because I figure it's got to be consistent for me to turn to the boss to help me search my soul for the things that are chasing me and hurting me, right? I mean, so I write, I put, it says, it's, here's what it says. It says, we reviewed our fears thoroughly on page 68. We put them on paper even though we had no resentment in connection with them. So, first sentence, I'm afraid of elevators. Okay? We asked ourselves why we had them. I'm afraid the cable will snap and I'll die. So, there I got my first two sentences in my fear inventory. They're giving me specific directions for how to do this. Okay. So it says, self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. So my third sentence is a statement of my self-reliance. What I'm going to do about this fear. I'm afraid of elevators. I'm afraid the cable will snap and I'll die. My solution is to never get on an elevator. Right? Hey, I can think my way through this. So I'm going to stay off elevators. That's my solution. That's my self-reliance. And then it says, perhaps we're on a better basis. Perhaps there's a better way we think so. For we're now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. So I make that in a negative statement. I'm not trusting and relying on God to care for me and protect me. Because now I'm not going to get on elevators. I'm not going to answer the phone because we know who's on the other end with the creditor thing. I'm not going to get on airplanes. You know what I mean? And my life is going smaller and smaller and smaller, and pretty soon I'm back in bed, which is where I started. So I've got to, I can't step through my fears. It's not like I'm going to get on a jet every day for the next month to get over my fear of flying. I'd be scared every time. I'm afraid of flying. Because I'm that self-reliant, I guess. But anyway, so you see, there is a specific direction given to us that really is very freeing. It's my favorite inventory to write because they get to see why I am afraid. It's not mysterious. Good?
Yep. I want to go backwards just for a second. Sorry. I do that. Okay. In resentment inventory, my sponsor was very frustrated with me because in my saying, I'm fine, I had no resentments. Okay, so how do you write resentment inventory if you have no resentments? So what she did finally was she said, okay, I want you to take a picture of your life, the little snapshots in your mind of grade school, have five of them. Snapshots of your life in high school, et cetera, et cetera. And she said, and then we're going to take those through inventory. So I remember the very first one I did, I said, oh, I remember when my sister came over to my grade school and she slapped me in front of all of my friends. But I don't resent her. Right. But it was the way in which I could get to it without the threat of saying, I am resentful. Somehow, to me, that was like, it was horrible to say I was resentful at my sister, but the snapshot helped me. I could take that statement through resentment inventory, and it worked just as well as if I had said, I resent my sister for slapping me in front of my classmates.
You mean just writing it down that you?
No, I mean that was the way in which I addressed the resentment.
Okay.
I didn't say I resent her for it. I said I remember that she did that, and it was less threatening to me, and it gave me access to my feelings that were pretty covered up at the time. This was in the beginning. Now I resent all the time.
Progress. Progress. Hell yes. Come
Hell
on
yeah.
In. The water's fine. Yes. And so, so now about sex. It turns out that the sex inventory is not about sex. It is about romance, and it doesn't always have to be a sexual relationship. Like, I went back and I did my sex inventory from when I was in grade school. And I wasn't having sex with anybody, but I had all the symptoms that are in this about sex in those romantic attractions. And so I saw a pattern all the way from there. So it says, we reviewed our own conduct over the years past. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Whom had we hurt? Did we unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? I'd like to address that word unjustifiably. So to me, and I'm not the standard, but this is my understanding because they put that word in there. What are they saying? Unjustifiably arousing jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness is me using that as a tool to generate bitterness, jealousy, and so on in my partner to hook her in closer. Does that make any sense? That's my try.
Yeah, because if it comes naturally, that's not your fault.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So I'm in there manipulating. Where were we at fault? What should we have done instead? So for the longest time, I was sponsoring people, and they would answer all the questions except the last one. What should we have done instead? My answer was, I shouldn't have been there that way in the first place, over and over and over again. And you know, sex is like, it's this tidal wave, it's this tsunami. And you know, God gave it, we're not gonna debate why we have it, but I'm just saying, it may be that God gave it in part to create more of us. So, but we're alcoholics now. If I'm gonna give up drinking, where's my substitute? Well, then I'll get into pornography. Let's do a good run at pornography. That'll do it. Because it hits the central nervous system and it takes me out of where I am. What else would do that? A good drink. I begged God for 6 years, please will you take pornography away? I could not shake it. It was horrible, and I wanted it gone. There's a folk song, and the title of it is My Old Man Was a Man Like Lincoln. I wanted to be that guy. I love Abraham Lincoln, incidentally. I wanted to be like that guy. But I had this hidden life, and it steals life away because I've got something cooking, and I can't talk to you about it. Now, my aspiration was I wanted to live a life that's transparent. Now, I'm not doing anything in my life right now that I can't tell you about from right here. That's a good deal. That's a good deal. And plus, I feel so sorry for the women who are involved in pornography. It's like, if we think we've lost our souls. I remember one day I was going to go get an auto part on a main street in Denver. And so I missed my turn. So I turned on the next street and I was going to go back over to it. And I was looking to my left and I heard the passenger door open and close. And I turned around and there was this woman. And she was so thin. She looked like a little crow. And she was sitting in my car. She was obviously a streetwalker, a prostitute, and she was looking to do some business. And my heart went out to her. I just prayed for her. I felt so sorry that that's what she had come to. You know what I mean? And so I told people, if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, I think I would work with some way or other with prostitutes because they have lost so much. And when we do inventory, and I listen to a fifth step, and I hear some one of the people that I'm sponsoring say, it's okay, it was consensual because she said yes. with that prostitute. I asked him, I said, do you think she's any better off for having met you? You did nothing positive for her. Not that you could convert her or heal her on the spot, but you could avoid her. Anyway, here endeth the sermon. There was that one. Anything?
So, sex inventory.
Oh, hello. I need another drink.
You can have mine.
Yay, thank you.
So, what I said was it was 25 years before I did my sex inventory. I was talking to somebody before, and I was trying to describe what I've kind of gotten to as far as the difference between alcoholics and Al-Anons. And alcoholics tend to go, me, and it's all about me, and Al-Anons tend to go, it's all about you, and, you know, and we're looking to have you make us feel better. So I'm really dependent upon Mickey thinking I'm okay. And like he said, you know, he called me Saint Marie, and you know, anything that was gonna mess that up was not very welcome. When we first met, I remember we were in the car, and he said something about, are you a virgin?
Something about. Are you a virgin?
I'm not sure how he said
no,
it.
No, I'm teasing. I'm sorry. I apologize.
And I said, no. And he said, well, they didn't deserve it. That was nice. That was our whole discussion. 25 years later, I'm going, what if he finds out?
Let me just say one thing. I kept telling Maria in the course of our marriage, I said, there's a stranger between us. There's a stranger in this relationship, and I don't know what it is. And I mean, it was almost palpable, and it stayed, that stranger stayed there.
So I have this secret, you know. I was sexually active, you know. Now, that may not mean anything to somebody who's younger right now. It meant something in the 60s. I mean, in the 60s, it was like free sex all the time. But there was two sets of people, you know, the good girls and the bad girls. And for a while, I was a bad girl. And I didn't want Mickey to know I was a bad girl. I wanted him to love me and respect me as his wife. And respect me as the mother of his children. And I couldn't let him know who I had been. I wasn't the worst. I wasn't horrible. I was experimenting, okay? But to me, it was absolutely unacceptable. So, here I have a secret. And I don't know if all secrets are as corrosive, but that is a secret that's really corrosive. And so finally, this stranger between us was getting even obvious to me, which was hard. And I was, every once in a while, you know, I would be between sponsors and, you know, sometimes it's hard to find somebody you relate to, and I was between sponsors. But I really got the message from God that I needed to do a sex inventory finally. I had done resentment inventory, a little bit of fear inventory, no sex inventory. And so I sat down and I wrote my sex inventory. A lot of can't remember his name, one night stand, who the heck knows who he was. But I did my sex inventory. Well, I have no sponsor. Now, I'm not saying this is the absolute best solution, But I decided to do my fifth step with Mickey. And because I knew I was going to have to share it with him eventually. And he actually had ended up being the most honest and understanding person in my life. And so I fifth-stepped with Mickey. And I think I gave him all the details. I don't know. I mean, it's not like you have to. In some cases, sex inventory is about sex. And so I did that, and I was talking to somebody before. I was talking about how honesty is absolutely essential in this program. It's also a great, what's it called? Anyway, can't think of the word. It was great. We went on a 4-year honeymoon because I had been who I was. I've always committed to be who you want me to be. I've committed to who you are. I'm going to be a copy of you, whoever you are. And I was me, you know. I was me broken. I was me fallible. I was me having made mistakes. And I was totally accepted by him. In fact, you know, it was...
I'm sorry, there was a little electric interference on there.
Okay, I won't say it. But what happened was that the stranger left. And we went on a honeymoon for, what, 4 years or something? 5 years? Because I wasn't trying to be somebody I wasn't. And I thought that was going to be horrible, and it was wonderful. It was miraculous. And So, I've had people come up and say, well, you know, I just don't think that would work for us. That's fine. This is what we did. This is what happened with us. And the shame that I had went away. I was no longer ashamed to be Marie.
Pretty good deal,
that's,
huh?
That's a great deal. And, you know, I mean, I understand that I have a partner who is absolutely the most understanding, the most forgiving, the most loving person I've ever met in my life. I don't know that it's not possible with other people. So, you know, I think that the trust that we have today, even with the infidelity of the emotional infidelity, God has used that and built it into, I know he's going to tell me what's going on. He's not going to be secretive. I'm not going to be secretive. And that's where trust develops. So, is there anything that you I didn't remember?
How's our time? Okay. We just wanted to leave you on this little insignificant note. I mean, there's real miracles available to us. There's real miracles available. And it turns out there's no substitute for the truth, but not raw truth. We have to be considerate of people. We have to tell the truth in a way that does not harm them. So thank you for listening. Thank you for being here. And I guess, let's eat.